This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to this Joy 94.9 podcast.
We want to hear from you.
It's time for our listener survey. So head to the Joy website and let us know what you love about the station and your presenters.
Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on Joy's program production team, the volunteers behind Joy Podcasts.
The results of this survey will assist us in continuing to be the best possible station we can be.
Head to joy.org.au and have your say. Joy 94.9, your voice, your radio station.
Good afternoon. How long since you've been to Tasmania? I'm going to introduce you to a couple of business people, one who's an incredible farmer and the other who produces salmon. All from Tassie, all happening now. Stay tuned. Forget the football this afternoon. Just stick with me. Good afternoon. We are talking cravings. Hello, I'm Pete Dillon. It's 6 minutes past one right here on Joy 94.9. This is Cravings, your weekly update of food and booze. A big week ahead. The Age Good Food Guide Awards announced on Monday night. So it's going to be an industry night. If you want to eat out in Melbourne, can I give you a little hint? Don't eat anywhere on Monday night because all of the good business is happening in town as the winners and hats recipients of the 2017 Age Good Food Guide are announced. So we'll catch up with a few of the winners next week right here on the program where there's all sorts of things, Restaurant of the Year and Chef of the Year and all of that. So stay with us for next week's program because we will be looking at the recipients of the Age Good Food Guide Awards. But today, the people who provide that stuff that goes into the kitchen for chefs to play with, they are the farmers. And I've met a couple of people of late from Tasmania, people who are entrepreneurial and clever and have created extraordinary businesses that will really play on the world stage when you hear the stories of what these people have done in what is sometimes challenging conditions. The first person I want to introduce you to is a fellow by the name of Will. He is from Thorpe Farm. Thorpe Farm is in Bothwell, right in the middle of Tasmania. It's sort of, if you want to get, you can get to anywhere from Bothwell and from Bothwell to Bothwell from anywhere. It's sort of, if you dropped a little pin in the middle of a map of Tassie, you'd probably find Bothwell. Will is an intriguing man, and we caught up just a little while ago, and I started by asking him what his farm was all about and how Thorpe Farm came about. Enjoy this. It's a really lovely chat. He's a very engaging fellow. This is Cravings here on Joy 94.9. It's almost 8 minutes past one.
So we're up in Bothwell in the Central Highlands of Tassie, pretty much almost middle of everything, so you're on your way to everywhere. Basically, we've been here for a long, long time. I'm seventh generation on the place, and traditionally we were a wool and beef enterprise. We've basically diversified pretty heavily in the last 40 years to adapt to the changes in farming, and now we're a pretty heavily diversified operation doing everything from wool still through to venison, boutique vegetables, on-farm tourism, paddock to plate, catering, that sort of stuff. So we've had a bit of a go at everything to try and sustain ourselves.
And has that worked? That changing changing face of the farm, I suppose, with adding all sorts of things in into the mix?
Yeah, look, it's basically a case of you've got to adapt or die in agriculture in particular. You can't really stand still with what you're doing. You've got to just keep working forward and either getting better at what you're doing or looking to new horizons. You know, we've kind of, the business was underpinned by wool and meat as such, red meat production, and it still is ultimately, but what we do on the site to help diversify our income stream and mitigate risk is for us. Pretty heavily. It takes a lot more effort, that's for sure.
You said you're seventh generation. Has it always been Thorpe Farm?
Yeah. So it was named by a guy called Thomas Axford, who isn't related. He came out to build a flour mill and ended up getting this grant off someone who did a land swap. And our original house as such was just 600 metres away from this block. And, you know, as marriages and surnames change through the generations, we've always been here holding the same titles, some of the same titles, and some of the farms next door and vice versa.
Well, give us a bit of a picture of the farm. So how big is it? What sort of...
So we're about 2,200 hectares, so it's quite large. It's like a big giant J. We're at the top of the J, right by the river, and it's quite long and skinny block. So all the blocks here are long and skinny, so everyone has a small piece of river frontage for irrigation.
Yep.
And that's where our intensive operations happen with the irrigation. We're growing poppies, Jerusalem artichokes, horseradish, salsify, all these other weird and wonderful veggies, plus a lot of red meat, growing grass and opium, which is a pretty stock standard mix in Tassie for this region. Then we go further across into the hills, so we're about 350 metres at the house, the top of the J, and as we go down to the other end of it, we end up at 480 metres,
yep,
which is a giant basin. The bottom of the J is a giant basin. It's about to get irrigation to it, which is very exciting for us. And that's 1 square mile big. So it's a big chunk of ground, and it's surrounded by bushland, remnant bush, which has been unchanged since white settlement. So we have probably 1,000 hectares of bush all around these basins, and we go right up to 980 metres, nearly 1,000 metres. So we get quite extreme weather here, and it's quite a picturesque place. There's a lot of bush, and then you've got your open country, and sheep love it.
And recently some snow.
Yeah, get plenty of snow up here. We get huge frosts as well. This year's been a bit uncanny. We've long hot summer and then the El Nino's come and it's been so wet that the water has saturated the ground and acts as a great buffer. And there's a lot of energy in water. So it doesn't get too cold this season, so the grass has grown a lot longer than normal. But we can get minus, I think the record's minus 14 and a half, which will freeze an egg. But, we consistently get minus 5 to minus 6. In those cold snaps, and in summer it gets up to 42, 44.
So it does get that hot as well. So it's quite extreme, extreme temperatures. Yep. How does the produce or how does the stock manage that? Or have you specifically chosen what you have?
Yeah, it makes tough sheep, that's for sure. they handle it, so it puts more flavour into them. We can say look, it's good sheep country. The bush is very good protection for the animals, for the meat. So, the animals can go in and lamb in bush and shelter and tussocks and native grasses, and the lambs survive and they come down into irrigation country and love it. So the sheep are a great fit like that, and they don't frost compared to other crops like wheat and things like that that'll frost, but you don't really see a merino frost. And we then go through and basically come down to low country and go into irrigation stuff. So what we're doing there is growing poppies, which is a great climatic advantage. Again, the long day lengths we get this far down south is great for growing things. And then we go into the boutique vegetable side of it. And again, that's capitalising on what I call environmental niches. So the soil gets very cold. We're sitting at about 5.8 degrees at the moment, down to 30 centimetres. So it's cold. And what plants have got to do to cope with that and these big frost events is put oils and things into their cells to make them resilient to the frost so they don't fracture and rupture and die. So, A, we've got to pick crops that are good and can handle that. So it's basically root crops.
So is that why you're growing things like horseradish and that sort of stuff?
Exactly.
Because they can handle those extreme temperatures in the earth?
Yeah, yeah, they love it. And the horseradish will take it, and it actually adds flavour to it. So it's putting the oil in, the isocyanate compound, the heat compound. It's actually a protective barrier to make elasticity in the cell wall. And when you rupture it, it has a reaction with the air, and that's how you get your hot root. So we're basically growing hot roots because it's bloody cold. That's the crux of it.
And look, a beautifully put expression as well.
It's a crude way to do it, but I say we sell good roots. That's what we do in Bothwell, basically.
Excellent. You can get a hot root in Bothwell.
Yeah, the hot root, you can get round roots, you can get long roots. It's all here, and they're bloody tasty. So, you know, what more could you want in life? We're pretty much capitalising on that is what we're doing. So we also used to grow strawberry plants.
Yep.
They're an alpine plant, and they like their winter chills. So they'll get their winter chill here by late autumn. They'd all basically had a winter, and we're dormant. We could dig them up, send them up to Queensland, and boom, there's your off-season fruit. So Queensland winter's more mild than a Bothwell winter.
Yep.
And, off they go. So, you know, all those sort of things have helped us. And basically all the veggies we're farming on a sand dune in the farm. It doesn't grow great grass, it doesn't grow great poppies, and we just grow in that because there's limited soil structure.
Mm-hmm.
So digging and mechanically harvesting and things doesn't do any real damage. It's easy to work with, it doesn't cling to the vegetables, and it's literally a 2 kilometre long strip split by a highway and 100 metres wide.
Okay.
Either side of it is just back to black clay. So it's a bit of sand dune perched on top of the normal clays around us. And, yeah, we're just sort of farming that pretty intensively.
We're listening to Will Thorpe. He is, Will from Thorpe Farm in Tasmania. He's a cracking fellow, and he's got a lot to share with us. We're going to hear a little bit more from him very, very shortly. But in the meantime, we need to be playing some community service announcements for you. This is Cravings here on Joy 94.9. My name is Pete Dillon, and it's currently 1:15.
We're listening to you. SMS 0427 JOY 949, email onair at joy.org.au, or call us 1300 JOY 949.
It's 14 degrees. You're here on Cravings on Joy 94.9. My name is Pete Dillon. We're heading for a top of 16 today. It's a miserable day. You might be on your way to the footy. Another big final. It's finals weekend, of course. So we're having a bit of a chat about Tasmania today, and I'm introducing you to a couple of people. One of those people is Will Thorpe. We heard a little bit from Will already. I'm going to share a bit more from Will with you. We're talking about his farm and diversity. He's quite a character, but at the same time, he's quite an entrepreneur. Here's a bit more of that discussion with Will from Thorpe Farm in Bothwell, in the middle of Tasmania. You're on Cravings here on Joy 94.9. My name's Pete Dillon. Will, do you sit down and research, you know, into the evening, what's going to grow where and how and well and why?
Yep.
How much of what you do is research, and how much of it is, if you'll pardon the expression, dumb luck?
Look, it's not really dumb luck. I think we watch what's going on and understand our environment well and what grows here, and we look around us, you know, doing a bit of homework before you start. So the latest one we've gone into is celeriac. So I started reading up on it, and I'd seen a bit of it on YouTube and realised that, again, it's an oil-based compound that gives it that celery flavour.
It's beautiful.
You know, they extract the oil from it. Yeah, and it's a nice, subtle flavour, and it'll grow slow. It grows very slowly up here compared to coastal stuff, but it's got a great flavour and it's got a long season. So that was the latest one, and I was watching it, and I could see it coming in on trend, you know, turning up a bit more and more, and my ears perked up. So, yeah, I'm into year three of growing it, and that's not a massive crop, but I grow about 12 to 14,000 heads a year, and keeps me out of trouble. Keeps me honest.
And what's the biggest challenge for you when you are diversifying so much, and you've got obviously land-based animals, and you've got?
I tell you straight up, time management. It's the crux of everything. Any business, it's very easy to get distracted and focused on one thing and drop the ball on something else. So, look, being as diversified as we are is actually very hard. It's and our clients, you know, they've had a good working relationship with Pure South for a while, and they, you know, they have weeks where we can't get anything out of us, or say when they're shearing or poppy planting, we've just got to say you've got to hold 3 weeks' worth of stock in your cool room because we won't be able to speak by the end of the next 2 weeks. We'll be that knackered, and, you know, that works in. But then there's other days when you drop the ball and the communication fails, and it's hard. It's bloody hard to do it consistently. which is a threat, you know, to the business. That's the biggest risk. You upset people, and it's hard work. For guys like me, who I'm more a producer, I don't want to do end products where my clients know it all. I want chefs to know my stuff and enjoy it and be showcased by someone else. Taking my product and they visit us and understand what I'm doing and then present it in a way and sell my backstory. It's not just another bulk ingredient, which is a magic, you know, magic feature and something unique.
Does it personalise your farm? Does it give your farm a bit more of a personal, or your business, a more of a personal identity rather than just being a box of horseradish or celeriac that's going to arrive on the door tomorrow from a green grocer? I mean,
that's something I've gone passionate into, I suppose is the word. Creating that backstory. Everyone talks about the backstory, but how do you convey it as a farm sat in the middle of Tassie with three people working on it? You know, like... And we don't want people coming and visiting because we're just flat out. And you've got to keep the place neat to do that. Like, how is to tell your story? So, you know, I've rebranded our boxes. I've created a nice logo. No one ever sees it except the wholesaler or goes in the back of a truck and sits in the cool room. But, you know, people start seeing it and recognising it and responding to it. And then I used online media quite a bit, so Instagram, Twitter a little bit, and Facebook to convey what we're doing and share our journey. That's been really good.
Utilising that media, I imagine there's a great deal of joy when you see a product that you've put in a box and has come over with a supplier, as a wholesaler, and then you see this beautiful produce on a plate that's been so well taken care of. I imagine you must derive a great deal of joy from that.
Huge amount, and that's why you do it. Because, I mean, when you send a bit of wool off, you know, we send out 50 tonne of wool, and we know some of it goes into business suits and all the rest, and you can't see a suit and you think, it could be mine. Mm. Whereas this is a full vertical integration, and you talk to the chefs about what size celeriac they want and what part of the year, and then, you know, you go do your delivery and they give you a taste of it or show you what you're doing, and you walk out with a real spring in your step. That's for sure. It's a positive reward for a pretty... Farming feels like a thankless task sometimes. It's a collection of very boring, mundane jobs. When you put it all together, it seems very interesting. You know, picking up bagging lambs and fixing fences and stuff. It's all pretty mundane jobs, but it's the collective amalgamation of it that's what farming is, and that's the exciting part. And when you're in product, you can see someone enjoy all those boring things you put together. It's bloody rewarding.
Talk to me about your drones. You've got drones that you use on the farm. How do you integrate drones into a farm like yours?
Taking pictures and putting them on Instagram. Everyone goes nuts for them. It's quite amusing. Look, I have been a pilot, had a little business flying gliders out at Hobart and doing scenic flights, and loved aviation and commercial space, and I like to try and be entrepreneurial, so... I also fly radio control planes and like that idea. And I saw the drones sort of popping up 5 years ago, got into it, got active about 4 years ago, built my first one just out of scrap gear, and could see the links between my farming and like what we call precision agriculture. I could see the links between that and the drone and the data it could capture and some positive outcomes. So started mucking around, joining the dots, found a bloke who I knew through flying, and he was a bit of a dude. And he just got his act together and got his full commercial license for drones. Basically, yeah, I went up to him with a beer and said, hey, you want to form a business? So we formed up our little company flying drones. We do all sorts of stuff from farm modelling. We can model farms incredibly accurately as a 3D model. And then you can do drainage and slope, irrigation scheme planning, lots of planning tools and, you know, mapping your farm accurately. Then we can go into crop vigour mapping, looking at different spectrums of light and how it reflects off the canopy and telling us how well crops are going here and there. And from that, we can change irrigation patterns, change fertiliser regimes. Or when we come back to crop the paddock the next year, we can look at the troubled spots, go straight to them and say, right, what's going wrong in this 7-hectare chunk here and what's happening there, and really drill down on what you're doing, what you've got to do. So it keeps you very focused. Compared to walking into a 50-hectare paddock and going, I think it was bad over there last year, I can't remember. You've got a full-blown data set. So, and I take sheep with them as well. Pretty handy for that in flooded paddocks.
Find your stock, I imagine.
Yeah, you can get in. We've got thermal cameras on them, so you can pop up and you can see stock and count wallabies and all that sort of stuff. You know, quantify vertebrae damage, all that sort of thing. There's so much you can do with them. The drone's just a platform. It's the data you get with it that's cool. So it sort of hits all my hobbies in one. I love computer games and 3D modelling and CAD, and it all just feeds into that.
So you're a bit of a tech head as much as you are getting out there and getting your boots and your hands dirty.
Oh, yeah, massive geek. Massive geek. I've loved computer games since I was a kid and building and trying to make systems and stuff. Like, I love all that sort of gear. But, yeah, I also love getting on the end of a welder and fabricating stuff, and that's my creative outlet, if that makes sense. Like, some people have got music or art or something else, and my creative outlet's building things.
How important to you, and I'm not suggesting in broader agricultural sense, but how important to you is technology in managing your farm?
Look, it's not the be all end all. It's not a silver bullet. I used to try and record everything online in farm management books and that sort of stuff, on the cloud. I've kind of stepped back onto paper for some stuff, and then other things like calendars and planning and organising stuff I love. I can't live without it. I get a morning email in my inbox at 5 a.m. telling me what I've got to do today. As long as I put it in the calendar, I love it. The software side of managing invoices and stuff, we're just getting into that. And then in the precision ag space, I think there's a massive void right now of how to handle these reams. We make gigabytes of data every time we do a job. And what you do with it's the big question. And the tech is just one part of it. If you're not motivated, you're not going to get the outcomes. You can be just as good a farmer without all the tech, with a really good intuitive gut instinct. And because you're putting together so many complex variables to try and win. You know, you're technically pushing it uphill or going up a river without a paddle.
The proverbial creek.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, is there a dream? Is there an end goal for you where you could sort of sit down and put your feet up and go, I've done all of those things?
I want a helicopter. Yeah. Not so I can afford a helicopter, I'll be having. I'm desperate for one.
Right.
That's my end goal. If I can get that, and if I can take you to ride in the chopper, you'll know I'll be grinning inside like a Cheshire cat. But, look, for me, my end goal is just to have a farm that I've got three little boys, and if they want to come onto the farm and become part of what we're doing in our story and take it through, that's a happy life for me. So I just want to focus on the people in the journey. I don't want to focus on the land itself as the centrepiece. The land's just a mechanism for what we're doing, but if we've got strong people around us and a strong bond, then I think that follows with it, a healthy business and a healthy landscape. So want to come in.
Would you say you're a custodian rather than an owner?
Yeah, totally. And you learn that. Once you've been here for 190 years like us, you learn custodianship's what you are. You can make your dent. You can only make so much of a dent on what you do to the place, fences and laneways and roads and irrigators and stuff. But, the next generation comes along and they want to do it completely different. And you've got to release that dream you had of what you where you wanted to, bring the next one in. So that's that custodianship, handing over and transitioning through to the next one. And, that's why I think if you focus on the people in the business, that relationship from clients through to, if you transition and someone starts making mistakes and you've got a shitty client, it doesn't help. If you've got a good client, like Pure South, they'll work with you through the challenges, give feedback and help you go. That's a very strong thing. So
I suppose that's what I want to do. My final question then takes me to sort of back to that custodianship. If you can imagine the man that wanted to build a flour mill all of those years ago, what would be his reaction to what the generations have been able to create?
Oh, he'd be laughing his head off, I reckon. Be amazed. And that's it. I think that's that thing about being elastic and dynamic and, going into these vegetables and all these things. It's just all part of that story. You can't predict where you're going. I couldn't predict that we'll be doing drones now, I dreamed of going into overhead irrigation 20 years ago into poppies and that sort of stuff. But then the drone side of it and the options that opens up, just blow me out. So it's cool. And you sort of sit back and love it all. And, it's good fun. when it all comes together.
When it all comes together is probably the operative word. Mate, really good to talk to you. Thank you for allowing us to intrude on your day.
Yep, beautiful. No worries. Thanks, Matt.
Good on you. We'll continue success, buddy. It sounds like you've got a marvellous operation. I look forward to getting the chance to catch up and chew the fat a little more about what it is and your special place in the world.
Yes, no, thank you. Cheers.
G'day, I'm Pete Evans, and you are with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Yes, indeed you are. This is Pete Dillon here on Cravings on Joy 94.9. We are talking all things Tasmania today. A really interesting discussion with Will from Thorpe Farm. He's a fascinating character, and I'm looking forward to catching up with him again to see if we can explore a little bit more about what it is that makes him tick.
Bonjour, I am Gabriel Gatte. You are listening to Cravings with Peter Dillon on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Yes, you are. Hello. It is 23 minutes to 2. The next person I want to introduce you to, if you were listening a little while ago, you may have heard a discussion with this woman already. She is from Huon Salmon, and whilst we're talking Tasmania, I thought you might enjoy having this. Her name is Frances Bender. One of the things Tasmania is most noted for is, of course, beautiful, beautiful salmon. Frances Bender is from Huon Aquaculture and is here to sort of share the story with us, if you will, about how Huon came about and its relationship with other growers, certainly in Tasmania, and then how it's placed itself probably on a global stage. Frances, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Tell me how Huon all came about, because I understand this story of sort of a collective of growers, if you will, of salmon farmers evolved into what is now. Take us through the journey.
The journey for us began actually 30 years ago this year. It's our 30th anniversary.
Congratulations.
In 2016, yes. we're actually one of three salmon farming companies in Tasmania now, but when we began 30 years ago, there were 14. And we started off in an industry that simply didn't exist before. So it's been an amazingly fantastic ride. Very dynamic, very exciting, massive highs and massive lows, to actually now be the largest agribusiness, agri-industry in Tasmania, and the largest fishery by value in the country.
Wow, that's a big standing
start of not existing 30 years ago. Yeah, it's worth about $650 million a year now as an industry, and it's an amazing success story for Tasmania.
Well, it's an amazing success story for you. Take me back to those days 30 years ago when it all started. How did you decide that farming salmon was going to be a way forward, or was it just a whim to you know, help grow your then? Were you in cattle farming?
Yes. Peter and I were managing his family's cattle and sheep farm. So we had about a 3,000-acre property, and we were growing a beautiful herd of Murray Greys and fat lamb sheep, and we owned the little local butcher shop. So that was our first foray into the retail world of selling our produce. And we saw... The farm actually has a lot of waterfront, and it's a beautiful area just down south in the mouth of the Huon River. And the industry was just starting around in Dover, and we thought that there might be opportunities for us to perhaps diversify into fish farming as a way of Peter and I becoming perhaps more independent. And our first thoughts were that, you know, if we could make a success of this, perhaps we might earn some money to be able to buy a family farming property. Little did we know the monster we would create.
Why fish? I mean, if you've got that lovely big parcel of land and you've got sheep and cattle, was there not a thought of diversifying into another form of agribusiness rather than aquabusiness, like growing horseradish or potatoes?
This is agribusiness, and it is farming, and that's what people possibly still get confused by. They probably think that because there's water involved, it must be like fishing. But one of the main reasons that Huon Aquaculture has been successful and our company has been successful and is the only founding company to survive since the beginning of the industry till now is the fact that we have never forgotten we were farmers. So it's always been about farming and the way we look after our stock and that attention to detail and those principles of farming is what stood us in good stead.
Well, sort of
from then till now.
Preempting a question there, I suppose, but how similar then is farming salmon to farming any other sort of stock?
It's very similar. It's just wetter. So you really need to look after your stock, which of course any farmer does. You need to feed them well. You need to keep them stress-free, and you need to look after their environment. And those four pillars are what we actually now call the Huon method. And if you manage those four pillars well, and they're all totally and utterly interlinked, then you will actually be successful at farming. So whilst that sounds simple and sounds very basic, that is the basic platform. But obviously then we have, I think we can claim quite honestly that we've been probably the most innovative farmers. In fact, we would be recognised as some of the most innovative salmon farmers in the world because I think we had the advantage and or disadvantage of being so remote to the rest of the salmon farming community that's based in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm.
We've always had to look outside the square and to think about different ways of managing a problem. We haven't had off the shelf equipment. We haven't had, in the early days particularly, right up until recently, we didn't have easy access to funds. We grew the business by the reinvestment of dividends and debt, so we had very strong relationships with our banks. So money was hard to come by, so we had to sort of look at every part of the business and how we could get the best return. So it made us be very, very innovative, and we've always looked outside our region and our area to looking at best practice and then adapting that to the Tasmanian environment, which is actually very different. Farming here is very different to farming salmon in the rest of the world.
So do you still look to the rest of the world, though, for those little bits of inspiration for your innovation? Do you sort of see something that's
absolutely
happening in the Northern Hemisphere and get an idea on how that can be adapted to suit your property?
Absolutely. We actually currently, we have a research and development arm of the business, and we are working with overseas entities, research entities, universities, centres of excellence, including our own centres down here, IMAS, the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Science, CSIRO, constantly in programs and other universities all across the globe in the applied science of fish farming. So we have very close and robust links with researchers across the globe.
Frances Bender is my guest. She is one of the owners of Huon Aquaculture in Tasmania. A fascinating discussion we're having already. I've got more of that coming up. Stay with me. You're on Cravings here on Joy 94.9 with me, Pete Dillon.
All day, every day. Joy 94.9 on air and online at joy.org.au.
Do you still farm cattle and sheep?
The family still does, yes. But we don't. We were, for when we first started the fish farming business, we were doing both. We were managing the farm and the fish farm and physically working in both. And then in 1994, Peter and I approached the family and said they were looking at diversifying into another part of another business as well at the time. And we said, well, if we can raise the funds, will you sell us the business at that time, independently valued? They agreed. We found a bank silly enough to take us on. And
I think smart enough 30 years down the track. Smart enough 22 years later.
Yeah, and that was the beginning of the ride on the roller coaster that to some aspects I think we still live on.
Frances, would you look back and say it's been a wonderful experience, or would you look back and say, God, we've learned so much and, you know, we've got grey hair and we've sometimes wanted to pull it out or set it on fire or just walk away. I mean, looking back, giving it some historical perspective, would you suggest that it's been worthwhile?
Everything you've mentioned, we've thought.
Including setting your hair on fire.
Sometimes on a daily basis. It's been the most amazing journey, and people quite often say to us, you know, did you imagine that that your business had become this? And I look at them and think, well, no. No, we didn't. Was this planned? Yes and no. There's been enormous highs, and we still have fantastic highs. We have the most amazing team of people that we work with that share our passion, and that's an interesting thing. That's a really important piece of feedback that we constantly get from a range of visitors, is people comment to us about the staff that they've touched in their visit, about how passionate they are. And it's more than just a job for the team at Ewan. It's about loving what we do and just continuously improving. So I think the other thing that still completely astounds me, even after 30 years, is the learning curve. The learning curve is actually still completely vertical.
Mm.
So as soon as we get the answer to one issue, on the way to actually getting that answer, we've discovered another 50 questions we haven't thought about yet, or things we want to actually improve or need to improve, or opportunities that we can take. So it is just the most amazingly dynamic business. It's awe-inspiring in its level of dynamism compared to nearly every other agribusiness that we, you know, that we understand and have relationships to.
Frances Pendy is my guest. Frances, I wonder if you could sort of talk us through some of the challenges of farming fish. Obviously, there's going to be some point where you're milking the fish for roe. Obviously, there are also predators that would like to be interested in eating your fish. What are some of the big issues you face growing salmon?
Well, the big issues are the security of your stock. So we spend and we've invested a lot of money and time and research and effort into growing the very best smolt that we can. So we actually control the process now. When we started, we were actually just growing fish and selling our fish to, we were buying in smolt and we were selling our fish to other producers, and they were selling them in their brand. And then we realised that really wasn't working for us, and so we actually stepped out from behind the farm gate and we took charge of our own destiny in relation to our brand. Then we also realised that we weren't getting the quality smolt that we needed, so we needed to actually take charge of the process from egg through. So we actually now have a fully vertically integrated company where we manage the process from egg all the way through to consumer. So we have branded product on supermarket shelves, and we sell branded product into Asian export markets. So there's a level of expertise across every section of the business that's really world class. And so we've learned, I often comment, and this is absolutely true, that the two least qualified people in the business with no formal qualifications is Peter, who's the CEO and
yes,
managing director, and myself, who's an executive director, the founders of the business. Our staff are so highly qualified and so great at what they do that in the days when we might be struggling with a problem that they don't know about, you come to work and, you know, their passion lifts you up and gives you the impetus to keep going on, keep forging ahead and sort of sorting out the problem that you might be dealing with. But it's a business that if you have attention to detail in every single area, then you will succeed. You were saying about the problems that we have. We do have a major issue in Tasmania with an ever-growing number of very, very clever seals. And they love salmon. And
they do.
They work together in a team and they problem solve. And I'm sure that they text, because as soon as one of them has worked out a way to get in or to get a fish, they all know. So they communicate amazingly quickly. So in the last 2 years, our company has invested over $100 million in rebuilding and rebuilding a new patented pen that actually keeps the salmon in and the
seals out.
And that was developed in-house by Peter and the team. And it's a huge benefit for the business moving forward now, because it also means that we've created also a safe working platform for our staff to work on.
Well, of course. And that's the commitment to IHS, but also commitment to keeping your crop as productive as possible. So I want to go back to these seals because they are very, very clever. I understand that, you know, they worked out that if one of them sort of smacked its nose against the fence until it bled, and then they were taught to take turns in doing that until they made a hole. Is some of those you talked about them working together, they do really seem to be quite clever.
Oh, yes, no, they're very clever. They'll jump exceptionally high. It's amazing, actually, how high a 300 to 400 kilo seal, because this is the size we're talking about. These are seals that are monster seals,
yep.
And they can jump metres high. So we have a 3-metre high jump fence on the new Fortress pens, which is the name that we've called our new pens, a 3-metre high external predator fence. We've now, just of recent time, actually witnessed massive seals using their flippers to climb, using
really?
The mesh to try and climb out of the water. They charge the net, and if there's any holes, they'll force their way through. They don't seem to be concerned about getting caught, which sometimes is really a bad thing, because sometimes they will get caught getting out, and then sometimes occasionally we will have had a seal that's drowned itself, and because it's under the water we don't know that. But we don't have many incursions now with these new pens, because in Tasmania seals are still listed as endangered and they're protected. So we're in their environment and we actually have to keep them out and our fish in. We have no other way of dealing with them. They don't actually have a natural predator, so their numbers are growing. So that's why we took the decision to actually move to this new style of pen once we had the technology. And the other reason we did that is also because these pens are extraordinarily robust but flexible. And because we have moved offshore now with our farming, kilometres offshore in very, very exposed open waters, some of the most exposed salmon farming waters in the world, we needed a pen that would actually be able to stand up to the storms of the Southern Ocean.
I was at work.
I was riding my horse.
I was microwaving a watermelon.
My iguanas escaped.
There are lots of reasons why you may have missed your favourite show, but don't worry, because our podcast team has you covered. They'll work through rain, hail and national glitter shortages to bring you the best bits of every show. Visit joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab, or head to the iTunes Australia podcast store and subscribe to your favourite shows for free. Thanks to our podcasters, you'll never feel guilty about missing a show again. Joy.
Well, that's almost me done, folks. We've had a great chat of things at Tasmania. Next week, as I said, we'll be looking to meet some of the wonderful folk from the Good Food Guide Awards. It is happening this Monday night. It's something that you need to be invited to. I'm very sorry you're going. I am. So I shall be back next week, no doubt, with some noise from who is the restaurant of the year, chef of the year, who got three hats, who got two hats, who lost a hat, who only got one. And then coming up in weeks further, we'll have some more interesting industry professionals for you to meet as well. I'll be back next week. As I said, it's Good Food Guide Week. Until then, it's been a delight to have your company, as always. You're here on Cravings. I've been Pete Dillon, and it is coming up to 2 o'clock.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation. Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.